Welcome to CrimPod. In this episode, we're going to examine the costs of serious and organised crime. Now, the AIC has a long history of measuring the costs of crime. And more recently, we've turned our attention to serious and organised crime, examining the costs of offences such as illicit drug trafficking, serious fraud and corruption. Now, we've just released a report that measures serious and organised crime costs for the financial year ending June 2021. It showed that the cost to Australia was a massive $60.1 billion. That included $43.7 billion for the costs associated with the criminal activity involved and $16.4 billion for the costs of dealing with it for both the public and private sectors. Today, I have Michael Phelan join me to discuss the findings from the report. And as both director of the AIC and CEO of the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission, there is no better person to give an insight into the findings from the study. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. This CrimPod session is about our report on costs of serious and organised crime. And I think what's really interesting about this is that we've got a cost which is up to $60.1 billion this time around for the year up to June 2021. That's quite an increase on where we were in 2017 when the figure was $47 billion. And I guess the question is, that's a 27% increase in 4 years. Is that a cause for concern?
It's definitely a cause for concern. It's also important to note we had some changes in methodology this time from 4 years ago. We've had a lot more detail in terms of how we cost drug crime in particular, and I'll talk a little bit about that as we go forward. So out of that, for example, there was $8 billion worth of increased costs. Also in relation to cybercrime itself, where we had an increase of just under $1 billion to $3.5 billion worth of direct costs for cybercrime. So even if you scrub out the methodology changes, we've still got a 9% increase over that period of time, taking into account inflation. So any way you look at it, it's still a big problem. And if you overlay that with the current economic situation in our country, whilst we have relatively stable economic growth, and in fact, a little bit of backwards following the pandemic, organised crime during that period has flourished. So much so that as a proportion of GDP, it's actually increased, which is the biggest worry.
So a growing business during the COVID time then?
Organised crime during COVID proved to be extremely resilient. So in the beginning, like any other business, their supply chains were affected, which we all saw in our day-to-day business with our commodities that we would buy ourselves. So given that the vast majority of the illicit products that produce the revenue for organised crime come from overseas, their supply chains are very similar to the everyday goods we buy, whether they be televisions, fridges, and so on. And just to put that a little bit in context, the biggest threat from organised crime in this country and most of their wealth is driven by illicit drugs. The vast majority of our illicit drugs comes from overseas. So, for example, 100% of heroin comes from overseas. 100% of cocaine comes from overseas. We estimate that 70% of our methamphetamine comes from overseas. The other 30%, roughly, is domestically produced. And even the domestically produced methamphetamine, 100% of the precursor chemicals come from overseas as well. So our supply chains, as in our normal business, that were hit hard in COVID in the beginning, were also hit hard part of organised crime. However, they became very resilient and they were pretty much back to normal after only 6 months or so. And now it's back as business as usual, unfortunately, in an area of growth.
But that's an interesting point, actually, around resilience of supply chain. I guess that affects organised crime in general, but also the revenue that they can generate.
So unlike legitimate businesses, of course, they can be nimble because laws do not matter to them, nor do borders. So if they can find a way to get around the normal trade restrictions that legitimate business faces, then they'll find that way. Particularly supply chain infiltrations and trusted insiders is an increasing issue as well, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit further when we talk about professional facilitators.
So you mentioned there have been some changes in the methodology to the report, and that's quite important when we're looking at comparing year-on-year changes. What's been happening there? What changes have occurred?
A major change is the cost of pure cybercrime. So here we're talking about pure cybercrime in a sense of victims being targeted and the losses generated by them and by businesses as a result of ransomware, also phishing emails and so on, just cash going out the door and the costs attributed to that particular crime type. So just under $1 billion in 2017, up to $3.5 billion in the latest report. And that also makes sense because we've seen lots of reports recently about the increase in cybercrime and no doubt also during the pandemic when there's been an increase in computer usage right across the board in our country and indeed in many other countries around the world, they've seen an uptake in cybercrime as well. It's seen as not a relatively easy crime to perpetrate, but it is seen as something that is a little bit less dirty than drugs, for example, but nonetheless absolutely as harmful. Generally, the people that are losing money to cybercrime are those that can least afford it.
Were there any other major changes?
The major changes in relation to how we counted the influence of drugs. Now, since the first report came out in 2017, the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission has run what's called our wastewater analysis. Now, that wastewater analysis, we've had 14 reports. They come out 3 times a year. Those reports cover 54% of Australia's population. So anybody who knows anything about statistics will tell you that that's a fairly good measure across all of those drug types that I mentioned earlier on before and a few others, including alcohol and tobacco. So we have a fair bit of granular detail now about exactly how much of each commodity is used, which we didn't have in the original report 4 years ago. There was a lot of anecdotal evidence used and other measures were used as measures of demand. So, for example, a percentage of seizures at the border and so on. But now Australia has one of the most robust measurements of demand of anywhere else in the world when it comes to illicit drugs. Then what we're able to do here at the Institute of Criminology is overlay that with other intelligence. For example, the National Illicit Drug Report that goes out every year, which talks about not only the seizures, but the amount that consumers both at the wholesale and at retail level pay for their drugs. So therefore, we know how much is being used. We also know how much is being paid for it by the mums and dads at the retail level and also at the wholesale level. So it gives us a lot more fidelity around the numbers when we're reporting them in this report compared to the last one. But unfortunately, even taking into account the changes in methodology from counting this report to the last one, we still saw an over $4 billion increase in the direct costs of drug crime, which again is a worry. And it goes to show that drugs is the main driver of organised crime in this country. And that stands to reason because of the high amount of revenue that it generates for serious and organised crime.
So what's driving that in terms of prices, the cost for illicit drugs in particular? Why is that going up in Australia?
Yeah. Drugs is no different than any other commodity in the real world. It's a simple economic equation of supply and demand that determines the price. Unfortunately, in Australia, Australians are willing to pay a higher price for their drugs than anywhere else in the world.
What's different about Australia?
We're a relatively wealthy country, and there is a lot of, I don't want to use the word spare cash, but there is a lot of cash that's used in relation to purchasing drugs in this country. And unfortunately for my sins, I've been doing this for over 35 years now in law enforcement. In particular, the last 15 years, we've seen the drug prices in this country relatively stable. So the wholesale price for heroin, cocaine, and meth in its various guises has stayed relatively stable, except for an inflation factor over the last 15 years or so. This is despite the fact that law enforcement has made some extremely significant seizures over the last 5 to 10 years in particular. The Australian Federal Police and the Australian Border Force, working with their external partners, do a magnificent job in the amount of drugs that are seized. But we've been able to see through some longitudinal studies at the ACIC and also in the AIC, where we overlay that seizure data, particularly major seizures, and overlay that with the wastewater, which is a measure of demand and the actual usage, that we've seen that after major seizures in this country, particularly of ice and cocaine, there is a dramatic drop in usage in the order of 15 to 20% in the next month or two after those large seizures. Then it gets back up again. So it does show that law enforcement has an effect when they do these large seizures, but it also shows how robust the economic equation is and how demand-driven the equation is in this country.
Yes, it's almost like a just-in-time supply chain, right? Yep. So if you're seeing an immediate decline in availability following a seizure, it suggests that it's probably not in a big warehouse somewhere holding it. It's probably coming in just when it's needed.
Exactly right. We here in law enforcement Australia, both from an intelligence point of view and in our operations areas right across the board, whether it be state or federal authorities, we do not see massive stockpiling of any type of commodity in this country. It is very much a just-in-time market. So narcotics and synthetic drugs are ordered, and when they land, they're almost entirely pre-sold at the wholesale level, and then it's moved very, very quickly through the distribution markets through our major capital cities, and increasingly so in our regional centres in Australia. And we've seen through wastewater analysis that, unfortunately, pound for pound, some of our regional areas use more per capita in some illicit substances, particularly meth, than is used in our urban centres. So Australia is a large market. And when we talk about a large market, the retail market alone is worth over $10 billion in cash. So just to put that in perspective, that's actual cash that must transfer from someone's hand to go to a drug dealer at the lowest level and then move up the chain. So just intuitively, if you think about that, the opportunity costs for society in general of that cash going out the door to criminals is massive. At its most basic level, you're talking about money going out of the hands of mums, dads, uncles, aunts, children that's not being used on food, shelter, the basic necessities of life. And we see that every day. And the interesting thing about an analysis of the demographics of drug use in Australia is that it's generally across the middle class of our society in any case. And that's what causes the biggest problem for us, because we are prepared as a country to pay more for our drugs. So it's very much demand driven.
And the fact that we're seeing an increase in costs, even taking out the methodology changes, is that an increase in demand, you think, or is that about retail price changes?
Look, we have seen an increase in demand, but the meth market stayed relatively stable since we've been doing the wastewater analysis at around about 8 up to 10 tons a year. So we're only talking swings of 10% or so. Cocaine has certainly gone up a fair bit. We've seen in the beginning of the wastewater analysis around 3.5 tons, and we're now up to over 5. And so that generates massive amounts of profits for serious and organised crime in this country right across the board. And as I said, the wholesale prices have stayed relatively stable, and indeed so have the retail prices. Now, there's small movements in price for shocks and small supply reductions. So a good example is the beginning of COVID, when the Western Australian government shut their border to almost everybody, including air traffic. Now, we saw meth use go down a very large amount, with the price skyrocketing as well. So straight out economics again. The demand stayed as it was, and the price was pushed up because supply was squeezed, but not so around the rest of the country.
So we talked a bit about what those costs are and how the market's changed, and a bit about what's driving it. But what do we do about that then, in terms of how can that be addressed as a problem?
This report, of course, talks about the cost of serious and organised crime. We're estimated at the upper level at about $60.1 billion this time, of which a large share of that relates to illicit drug activity, over $16.5 billion. And those costs are made up of the medical costs associated with the drug problem. It's also the lost output, something that doesn't necessarily come straight to mind when you talk about drugs. You think about the money that they're paying us on. It's also the lost output from someone who's addicted, who's taking days off work, who's doing all those sort of things and not being a productive member of society. We're able to cost those things as well. And then, of course, the actual expenditure on the drugs themselves, so the cash that's gone out the door. So what can we do about all that? We need to reduce those costs, because we all bear the costs of serious and organised crime, particularly drugs. So whilst it might sound quite counterintuitive coming from a law enforcement officer, it really is one of those crime types where we've got to try and reduce the demand. And it's about education and health. And we've seen, for example, as I said a little bit earlier, when there are short-term shortages created as a result of seizures by law enforcement, the usage goes down, which means people can tolerate the usage going down. And this comes back to what I was saying before about a large proportion of meth users, for example, being just what we would call the middle class sector of our society, where they do have the spare cash, that's the time to hit with education and health initiatives. So when the usage is down, try and keep it down rather than letting it go up. I certainly have no silver bullet would solve that, but certainly it has to be a three-pronged approach. There is absolutely no doubt that we need to keep our foot on the throat of supply, with law enforcement doing what they need to do and working with our overseas partners. But that needs to work in concert with our education programs and also our health programs. In my humblest opinion, it's about tackling the demand of the problem.
If you think about any market, you've got heavy users of something and a tail of lighter users. And I suspect this is an area where you've got a large cohort of recreational users, and that's probably the ones that get hit with the price changes in the first instance, because they're the ones that probably price themselves out of the market.
Indeed, and that's the sort of thing that does actually require a fair bit more research. So to actually break down the demographics of drug use to work out where we can best target as a country initiatives around demand reduction. Never underestimate how damaging it actually is to our society. And frontline law enforcement and emergency services see it all the time. They see the effects of people on ICE, and not only those individuals, but what it does to their families as well, through the increase of domestic violence, the increase in other violent activity that occurs throughout the home, and the loss of available income for other things. And it manifests itself in children not having enough clothes for school, maybe skipping school. And that, of course, has long-term effects for all of us and as a society. And that's what the vast majority of us in society are shielded from. We don't actually get to see that.
I guess that's why reports like this are useful, to actually quantifying, if you like, some of that harm.
Yeah, well, they do illuminate the problem. Whilst some of us have only a couple of degrees of separation, perhaps between someone that we know who's involved in drugs, you know, as a user or something similar, the everyday effects of that $60.1 billion we all pay through our taxes or through the opportunity cost of where that money could otherwise be spent on building more schools or more hospitals, but we have to spend addressing the organised crime problem. Even if we look at out of the $60.1 billion, $16.4 billion is the costs of prevention. So that's private sector and public sector, protecting against serious and organised crime. And it's important that I say serious and organised crime here because we're not talking about all crime. We're only talking in this report about serious and organised crime. So all crime together would cost much more than the $60.1 billion.
Okay, I want to move on to touch on the role of professional facilitators. We come up with the cost of just over 800 million goes in commission to the facilitators to launder proceeds of crime. When we talk about professional facilitators, what kind of roles are we talking about and how important are they from an organised crime ecosystem?
It is structured very much along business lines, as I alluded to earlier on. There are supply chains, and supply chains are everything from manufacturing drugs overseas, transportation through to Australia, facilitation through customs controlled areas, which may or may not involve trusted insiders, the sale of the illicit commodity, whether it be tobacco or whether it be drugs here in Australia, that generates cash. That cash needs to be laundered, so turned back into legitimate funds so that the criminals can spend it. And all of that requires people with professional knowledge to be able to do. Now, some of them do it with the full knowledge that they're involved in serious and organized crime. Others do it unwittingly. And the sort of groups that we are talking about are just the same groups that you would need if you were running any sort of business that provided a commodity here in Australia. So you need transport and logistics. You need lawyers to help set up business structures for you, whether they be companies, whether they be trusts, whether they be partnerships to either hide illicit money and trying to turn it legitimate, accountants to be able to understand that. Believe it or not, some organised criminals actually pay tax on their illicit earnings as well through legitimate structures. If you're going to turn that into real estate, which is obviously a desire of a lot of organised criminals, then that needs to be purchased. Now, that can be purchased in a number of ways through developments, et cetera, through corrupted real estate agents who take money, for example, in the form of loans and then pay back commissions to organised criminals as we go forward in the form of a fee. And then all of a sudden, they've got a legitimate development that they've got their finger in, which will generate income for them over time, be it very small examples. But all of that requires professional knowledge along the way. Organised crime cannot exist without professional facilitators.
So you've already got a small group of highly trained professionals that are responsible for enabling organised crime to happen.
That's right. Well, when we say small, the small is in the hundreds and thousands, perhaps. And like I said, not all of them do it willingly or even knowingly for that matter. But everything has to find its way into some sort of legitimate business structure for someone to flourish. The other important thing is, of course, I know I've talked a lot about drugs here, but it's not just drugs. It's other illicit commodities as well. So in particular, tobacco. Traditionally, it was sort of a bit of a precursor crime towards more harder drugs such as ice and cocaine. But in itself, tobacco is a large problem because the supply chains are the same. But arguably, and this is certainly what organised criminals think, the threat is lower. For example, the amount of profit they make on one container means that they only need one container in 30 to get through full of cigarettes to make a profit. So if that's any sort of legitimate business and you're willing to write off 29 out of 30 containers, then it is lower risk. Other things such as intellectual property theft, of course, is a part of organised crime as well. And not one of their largest money spinners, but certainly one where they can generate significant revenue from. Organised wildlife theft, so on, and exporting of Australia's flora and fauna. Commonwealth grant systems or state grant systems or welfare systems. All those things generate money.
Well, I think that's all my questions. Thank you very much for taking part in this episode of Crimepod.
No worries. Thanks, Rick. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And thanks to you all for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to listen to future episodes, please like and subscribe. For more information about our research, you can visit us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, or our website at www.aic.gov.au. Thank you.